From claims of healings and visions to the world's most inexplicable events, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt.
EWTN Radio presents The Miracle Hunter with Michael O'Neill.
Welcome to The Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm The Miracle Hunter. There was big news coming out of the Vatican this past week related to the Virgin Mary and various titles that are used to honor her. And there's a new document is controversial in some ways because it refers to those controversial titles of co-redemptrix and mediatrix, titles that have been used in various Marian apparitions throughout history, some of which have been approved and then condemned. And so this is kind of a controversial sticking point. We're going to be joined today with Dr. Mark Miravalli, perhaps the top expert in the world on this topic, to talk about this new Vatican statement on Marian titles. We'll also be joined by Terry Haggerty, the executive director of the Trinity Heights Shrine in Sioux City, Iowa, which is the subject of the brand new episode of Hidden Gems. That's my new docu-series on EWTN, which stars as the host, Nell Angieski, from Catholic Church Tours. And this is the new episode that will be airing on November 10th at 4:30 p.m. Central Time. And Terry will be joining us to talk about that filming and his shrine and what people can expect to see in this brand new episode coming soon. And this week, They Might Be Saints, people can tune in on November 11th at 11th to They Might Be Saints, Bishop Alphonse Gallegos. He strolled the streets of Sacramento, saving souls by visiting families and mixing with lowriders in the Latino community. And I profiled the Bishop of the Barrios, Alphonse Gallegos. That is November 11th on EWTN television. My other series, Explore with the Miracle Hunter, we have a brand new episode. This is the second week of brand new episodes. Another episode coming out of Poland. This is Explore with the Miracle Hunter, Warsaw. On Saturday, November 15th at 5:30 p.m. Central Time, in 1920, Polish forces won a surprising victory against the Soviets to halt communism's advance and investigate the divine intervention that may have turned the tide. And that's Explore Warsaw on Saturday, November 15th at 5:30 p.m. Central Time. Again, a brand new episode, never aired before on EWTN. Later in the show, we're going to be looking at the Might Be Saint of the Day. For today, we've got Blessed John Duns Scotus, who lived from 1266 to 1308 in Scotland. And in the 365 Days with Mary Project is the Virgin of the 33 in Florida in Uruguay in the year 1825. I was about an hour away from that shrine, but never got to visit it. So it's a Marian title I'm very interested in. The question of the week, what was the most incredible place you filmed an episode of Explore? That's a really hard question. I'm going to take a little time to think about that one. And the miracle of the day, in 1950, on today's date, Pope Pius XII claimed to see a miracle of the sun. Let's take a look at the miracle news. We do this every week. We talk about the miracles happening around the world and those things that relate to miracles. And this is certainly not a miracle, but it relates to a place of miracles. And it's sad news, unfortunately. In Cuba, the hurricane destroyed the National Shrine of Our Lady of Charity of El Cobre. And so this Basilica of Our Lady of Charity of El Cobre is Cuba's most cherished sanctuary and a national symbol of hope and unity. It now bears deep wounds from Hurricane Melissa. It's perched in the foothills of the Sierra Maestra, 20 kilometers west of Santiago de Cuba. The sanctuary has stood for generations as the nation's spiritual home, but this time, even with its storied resilience, was no match for Melissa's 195-kilometer-per-hour winds and relentless rain. The quote says, "The walls trembled, the air howled, and the sanctuary seemed to breathe in anguish," said Father Rogelio Dian. He's the rector of the basilica. "We had never witnessed anything like this. The damage is extensive. Vitriol shattered, rain pouring into the church, parts of the masonry literally torn from the walls." In the wake of the extensive hurricane, this once radiant facade of El Cobre is marred by broken glass and debris, and parishioners who sought shelter within the church returned to find the sacred space wounded but still standing, a fragile image of the Cuban people themselves, as this article relates. And so So that's a sad thing that happened, the Basilica of Our Lady of Charity of El Cobre. I myself have not visited the shrine. I intended to, hopefully within this next year, but perhaps that church in resilience will be restored. The people of Cuba will likely attend to that national treasure. But sad that that nation and its symbol, the symbol of the nation, that basilica was damaged so greatly by Hurricane Melissa. A lot of prayers are needed for the people of Cuba. Let's take a look at Catholic Pub Trivia. We do this every week where we ask a trivia question and give out a prize to an emailer who writes in the fastest with the correct answer. Last question was a little bit of a very specific history question. In what century did Pope Gregory IV extend a feast day of All Saints on November 1st to the whole Western Church? And that answer, Pope Gregory IV in the 9th century solidified November 1st as All Saints Day. I think you probably had to be a church historian to know that one. A little bit of a tricky one, but it was in honor of All Saints Day. So this week's question, what was the most recent Marian title added to the Litany of Laredo? We're talking today with Dr. Mark Miravalli about titles of Mary, especially in lieu of this new Vatican document coming out on November 4th about Marian titles, what's appropriate and what's not. What was the last Marian title added to the Litany of Laredo? If you think you know that answer and want to win the prize, the image of the faces of Mary, send me an email to questions@miraclehunter.com and we'll see who has the fastest answer, correct answer, and answers and winners will be posted on the show page on miraclehunter.com. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be talking with Terry Haggerty about the brand new episode of Hidden Gems, about the Trinity Heights Shrine, Quinnipiac Shrine in Sioux City, Iowa. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. People who tune into this show know about my programs on EWTN, whether they be They Might Be Saints or Explore with the Miracle Hunter, some of the various hour-long programs we've been doing, like Miracles of Roses about St. Therese. But my brand new project that I'm so excited about is called Hidden Gems, Catholic Shrines Across America. And we travel across the United States and we partner with shrines to bring them to air on EWTN. And these are these incredible places of grace that you might not know of, might be in your home state or your backyard, or places you might consider going on pilgrimage. One of the beautiful new episodes that's coming out on November 10th is an episode about the Trinity Heights Shrine, the Queen of Peace Shrine, in Sioux City, Iowa. It's located on 16 acres there, and it's got incredible statues and sculptures and pathways. It's an incredible, peaceful place. And we're so excited today to be joined by the executive director of that Trinity Heights Shrine, and that's Terry Haggerty. Welcome to the show today, Terry.
Thank you very much, Michael. It's a pleasure to be able to come and talk to you on the show and talk about this amazing place called Trinity Heights.
Terry, tell us a little bit. How did this shrine, the Trinity Heights Shrine in Sioux City, come to be?
This beautiful shrine, it started way back in 1911 that this site became basically a holy site, with a group of priests coming together to write to the Vatican seeking a loan to build a high school for the young boys of the day back in 1911 that needed guidance and direction. So the Vatican agreed, gave them the loan, and they proceeded to build this high school and college that served Sioux City from 1913 until 1949, when Sioux City opened up a co-ed Catholic high school. And at that time, it stayed as a prep seminary and a college until 1968. In which as the way prep seminaries go, they decided that there weren't enough here, and they closed it down, and it sat empty. Well, there's a priest here by the name of Father Harold Cooper, And Father Cooper and his brother Bernard, also known as Beanie Cooper, went to school here. Father Cooper was a priest 2 miles south of here, and, you know, he loved this area, Trinity High School, and he had a great devotion to the Blessed Mother, and he started visiting up here again, and he took a pilgrimage out to Santa Clara, California, and he saw the statue of Our Lady out there, and it just clicked, and he said, why can't we do that here? This is a wonderful place. It affected so many of us, and it just needs something because it's getting run down. So he came back and petitioned a developer who had the property at that time. There was a whole frontage road down here that the property sat on, and he petitioned them and said, what is the asking price for the property? And they gave him a number of $300,000, and he said, well, I can't do that. So he had a little group, his mother, and there were four, sometimes six or seven. They'd come up in one car, or maybe twos, and they started praying on the site every afternoon at 4 o'clock, praying the rosary to see if they couldn't acquire this property. So after almost 3 years, the developer called him back and offered him the property at $90,000. So he had the backing to do that, and that's where we started.
That's beautiful. It's its own miracle in its own way for the price to drop like that.
You know, for 3 years to have that devotion, and rain or snow, and this was not a paved road up here. This was an old gravel road that came up, and it had ruts in it, and it was a process to get here, but they came every day. And to continue that devotion, the Blessed Mother made it happen. And once they had the property acquired, then it was, okay, we got our wish, we have the property, now how can we get the statue, and how can we build this devotion to the Blessed Mother? So it just evolves. It goes from that simple story of one priest, and then the people get involved that he had started to contact and say, I want to make this happen. And, you know, Michael, you know, when you start talking to people about the Blessed Mother, it spreads like wildfire. They want to be part of it. You're going to devotion to the Blessed Mother. You're going to do what? So if their devotion and if their feeling is there that a lot of us have for the Blessed Mother, then they're going to say, yes, whatever you need from me, I will do my best to give you. And he assembled those people and he got them together. And the people that early on that came aboard, you couldn't have scripted if you tried. I mean, there were things that a couple of people that he knew that were with him and got aboard. Well, I know this guy that I used to be in the service with. Well, I know this guy that I work with. And one of the board members, I know a sculptor. So it just kept rolling. You know, I know a guy that does demolition for buildings in Sioux City. So once the building and once his inner core started to grow and say, this is what we're going to do, it just mushroomed. And it was spectacular to see happen from the beginning to take this place that was run down. The windows were getting broken out of the buildings, and I had the wonderful attribute of growing up just about a mile and a half north of here in a little community called Leeds. So I knew Trinity High School and college. We used to come up and we actually practiced baseball in the field behind the school. So I had a real familiarity with the place. And then when they started to do the development, it was like a rebirth, you know. They took this place, and we always used to get we used to say it's the goosebumps as we'd walk through the woods on the north end of the property, and the brothers would be singing Vespers. And it was just absolutely gorgeous how it would echo out down through that timber to the north of us here. And then to see this all of a sudden start to get a resurgence, it was really, really, it was amazing. It truly was. So
we're talking today with Terry Haggerty, the executive director of the Trinity Heights Queen of Peace Shrine in Sioux City, Iowa. And it's the subject of the brand new episode of Hidden Gems, Catholic Shrines in America, that airs on November 10th. And that's at 4:30 p.m. Central Time. And we've described how this this shrine came to be, kind of improbably, miraculously, some might say, and it's turned into this incredible place of grace. And I think that people will be surprised to see in the episode some of the incredible, beautiful things that are there, including some sculptures of the Last Supper, a sculptured Last Supper, some pathways, and the giant towering statues of Jesus and Mary. Talk about some of the things that a pilgrim might see if they were to stumble across your shrine.
Well, you know, the calling card of what we have here is the Blessed Mother, of course, the 30-foot stainless steel statue that adorns the east end of the property, and that's where it all started, and it is just as beautiful today as it was in 1992 when they set the statue in. And the Queen of Peace statue, it just resonates with people. They got a sculptor that was able to capture so many of the things that you do when you envision you're going to a guy and you're asking him, make this statue that everybody's going to love, and you put it in his lap and he looks at you and says, you're got an awful lot of faith, and you just say, do it. And he hits this thing. He comes back with this statue that everybody simply is, it's awestruck when you sit, and we tell people, you know, go and look and sit on a bench and view the Blessed Mother as she gazes on you, and you look into her eyes, and it's as if she's smiling back at you and telling you that she is your mother and you are loved. And there are people that will tell you that that's the experience they get when they come here. So that was the first statue to go up, and it is magnificent, and there's nothing like it, of course, anywhere in the area. So it drew from this entire Midwestern area once the word got out. So from there, it has continued to evolve is a really good word of this place. They had a vision. Father Cooper had this vision of this statue, right? I want a statue. I want a devotion to the Blessed Mother. And then eventually at the west end of the property, we'll put a statue of the Sacred Heart of Jesus, because that's where she's leading you to. Well, in the interim, all between this life-size wood carving of the Last Supper becomes available by somebody that's 25 miles from us, that he turns down a superior offer, just an unbelievable offer of money to take it here, because he has a devotion to the Blessed Mother as well. And it's almost as if it's another miracle. It truly is, for that to be here, because that did something for the Queen of Peace that really just made it grow even larger, because that became a piece that appealed to those that just didn't have the Blessed Mother devotion. You know, this was a work of art that brought in people of all denominations, to be honest, that wanted to see this work of art. So then when they come, then we'd say, well, then they go around the rest of the ground. So it continued again. It wasn't scripted. That wasn't in the plans, but it happened. So it's always been from the beginning. Beanie used to say, all you need to do is pray to the Blessed Mother, and she will make it happen. If it's to be, she will make it happen. And that was the kind of the words he gave me when I came into this position. And you can go back through history and you can say, wait a minute, you had a timeline. No, there wasn't that timeline. That was not in the works. So another statue, the Sacred Heart, was placed after the Last Supper at the west end of the property. And it became the bookends. And we weren't done there. So it's continued to evolve. I love the way the episode, I've been able to see the episode, as many of you will, the 10th. And I think it was spectacularly done. I truly was so happy with your crew and what they did to make this place become alive and show people what's here. I don't want to give everything away. I want them to look at. I want them to watch that video and truly see for themselves this timeline and how these things come to be. And Nell did a great job, I think, of just showing that evolution in truly a miracle. Yeah, I think a lot of us think it is. So What's
yeah, that's very, that's very well put, and I agree. We're so proud of this episode, and Neil Andrzejewski, the host of Hidden Gems, did such a lovely job just showing off your shrine, and it's not hard to do in some ways, pointing to those giant statues of Jesus and Mary and the beautiful grounds there that all create a place of peace. And I think one of the very interesting aspects of the episode, and I'll let you just chat about this a little bit, is this Last Supper carving. To me, that was pretty remarkable. It's one of the highlights and one of the reasons that people go to the shrine is to see this. Tell a little bit about how that Last Supper carving came to be and what is it exactly?
The Last Supper carving was an idea of about a sculptor, and he's 25 miles north of here in a little town of Lamar's, and he's self-taught. He just decided one day, hey, I'm going to take up wood carving. And now we're not talking about a grinder and a chainsaw or power tools. This is a mallet and wood chisels. And that's how he would carve. And he won many competitions, you know, wooden shoes and designs, those kind of things. He's got some sculptures still in his shop of a head, those kind of things. And one day he came home to his wife and he said, you know, I'm kind of bored with that. I think I'm going to carve the Last Supper. And Arlene looked at him and said, Jerry, are you sure you want to do this? That's quite ambitious. And he said, no, I'm going to give it a try. So he lives in a little town and he had a workshop out back. And so he started, he uses basswood and pine, and he'd go to the lumber yards and he'd acquire them and he'd take them home and he'd create a big block of wood.
Yeah, talk about the scale of it a little bit. This isn't just a little desk size carving.
No.
This is life size.
This is truly life size. Yes, they are. You could stand next to Bartholomew at the end and he is the same size as we are and all of them behind. And they weigh about 250 to 300 pounds apiece. So it's not a small desktop. No, it is. It's 22 feet long, and like I say, it is a height of anybody standing there. So to assemble the block of wood to do that created a lot of work because he would glue pieces of wood together, and he'd use screws to attach them, and then he'd come back out the next day. Take the screws out. He'd repeat that process until he gets this big block of wood, and then he'd start to carve. Well, it took him 9 months to do one statue, and he went back into his wife, and he said, you might be right. I might be crazy trying to do this. Well, his brother-in-law came to him and said, you know, I've got a hydraulic press, Jerry, that just might make this a whole lot easier. So he did. He tried that, and it did, where he could just take the blocks of wood and he would glue them together, and then the press would compress everything and he could go back and he could just start carving. Well, to make it unique, rather than just like the painting was, he decided to use friends of his, an acquaintance and some family members, and he'd dress them up in an alb and he'd have them pose for him. So the facial features are a little bit different than what you traditionally see. You've got some longer hair, you've got some mustaches, you know, you've got more modern faces, so it gives it a little twist to what you normally see. But it also was a way to get his community involved. You know, hey, have you seen this? What Jerry's doing? And so the energy got going up there as well. So it took him 7 years. Now he's working full time in the post office, and he's doing this on nights and weekends. And 7 years is what it took him. And he puts it all together, and he takes it down to the Iowa State Fair, which is in Ames, Iowa, in the middle part of Iowa. And he puts it on display there. People are lined up for a mile waiting to get in and see this amazing work of art. So he takes it all back, takes it all back home, and Father Cooper and Beanie Cooper, his brother that was the executive director, they go up to him and knock on his door and say, Jerry, can we talk to you? What are you going to do with this amazing work of art? And he said, I don't know. I've been offered an awful lot of money to put it in a museum down in Florida, but I really don't want it that far away. I want to have it where I can keep an eye on it. You know, wood is, if it dries out, then it's going to ruin it. And so he said, I want to have it closer to home. So then they said, well, if would you take it to the Queen of Peace? And he said, well, you don't have a building. If we build you the building, would you put it there? And they said, yeah, we would build a building specifically for that. So they did. They had a generous banker that decided he would give them the loan, give us the loan to do that. And they built the building, and he donated it. He has it on display here. And there are people that, I mean, it is an amazing work of art. And they will travel to see that. They want to see the Last Supper. That when you get a lot of phone calls, when are you open and what are your hours? Because I want to see that Last Supper. So he put it in, and the doors opened up, and it has. It really has been a wonderful attraction, and it's such a beautiful, beautiful work of art that you really can't. It is so enjoyable to see people on the ground, and every once in a while, the building will be closed, and I'll be up after hours, and somebody will be here, and, oh, I came from so far away, and I wanted to see the Last Supper, and, well, come on, I got a key, I'll get you in. So we'll go in, and it's just such a pleasure to see the people and to hear the people when they walk in the room. It's like, you know, the gasp and the, wow, oh, my goodness, and they're just speechless. So Jerry has been a wonderful, wonderful supporter and friend of ours. He still lives 25 miles north of us in the same house that he's lived in, you know, for as long as I've known him. And for somebody that has that devotion to the Blessed Mother, because he wanted this place to take off and he thought this would really help, and it has, make it into a magnificent shrine that people need to come and see. And he says to me today, he'll say, you know, you've got a beautiful place there, and it is such a joy to have my piece there. So he's excited that it's here and that it's on display, and people do get the opportunity to see it. We do our very best to make sure it's in the pristine condition. He came to me in 2014, and he said, it's been 20 years, needs to be restained and revarnished. So we took it all apart. We spread it all out on the floor and put plastic down, and we restained and revarnished it. And he said, okay. He said, I'm 74. I'll be 94 at the next time. So he said, you'll be a little younger. Maybe you can pass that knowledge along. So as long as we keep it in good shape, I think he's happy. And it is a truly wonderful place, wonderful addition for us. So people need to come and see it. You just can't explain how gorgeous it is. So,
yeah, it's and we hope that the episode Hidden Gems, Catholic Shrines Across America, does justice to this place, the Trinity Heights Queen of Peace Shrine in Sioux City, Iowa. Terry Haggerty, we're so grateful that you participated with EWTN to bring this show to life, airing on Monday, November 10th at 4:30 p.m. Central Time. As we wrap up the interview today, what is your great hope for people who tune into the program?
Our hope since the very, very first knowledge of having this opportunity was that people would get to know us here and they would come and see what's here. I'm very partial because I've got to be here since the very beginning. It's just such a beautiful, peaceful place. If you look at the piece that's coming on Hidden Gems, and Nell does a great job of bringing that message along, it's a peaceful, spiritual place. Come, walk the grounds, sit, just listen, view the statues, listen to the nature around you, the water trickling. It is a place where you can come, and you can come in contact with God, and you can just listen to His beauty, and you can see the spectacular statues we have and the grounds, and I think you'll grow closer to God. And we're so excited, Michael, that this is coming on EWTN. We are truly hoping we're going to process of building a new chapel. It's getting nearly complete. We're doing some fine tuning, and we're hoping that when they come, they're going to join us for Mass, have a chance to go in and have reconciliation if they so choose. And that's what our desire is. You know, the Blessed Mother is our mother. She's our mother. And what is she doing? She's drawing us closer to her Son. And that's the goal. That's our mission. And EWTN, God bless you all there for what you do. And this opportunity to get the message out that Trinity Heights Queen of Peace is someplace. Make the journey. Come see us.
Well, God bless. Terry Haggerty, thank you so much for your participation in the project and for joining us today to talk about the new Hidden Gems episode, Trinity Heights Queen of Peace Shrine. People can watch that on Monday, November 10th at 4:30 p.m. Central Time. Thank you, Terry, for joining us on today's program.
Thank you, Michael. God bless you.
God bless. That was Terry Haggerty, the executive director of the Queen of Peace Shrine. You can go to trinityheights.com or if you're in Sioux City, Iowa, you should check that one out. Or go to shrines.tv to learn more about Hidden Gems and to watch this episode. But tune in Monday, November 10th at 4:30 p.m. Central Time to see the debut of this new episode, Trinity Heights, Queen of Peace Shrine on Hidden Gems. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be looking at the question of the week. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill and the Miracle Hunter. Hey, I love getting your questions. People write in from around the world with questions about miracles happening in today's world and those that have happened centuries ago. And I love hearing what people are thinking about. People fill my inbox with some pretty interesting things, interesting questions and comments. I also love answering questions in person. And I travel all around the country, probably about 20 times a year, where I speak in front of a parish or shrine or a conference. And I talk about miracles, whether it's miracles of the Eucharist or Marian apparitions or how the church investigates the supernatural or how saints are made. I talk about different topics. But I always love opening it up to questions afterwards to hear what people are thinking about. And I do my best to answer them. And people can send me an email at questions@miraclehunter.com or just go to my website and click on the contact tab and send me a message that way. And maybe I'll be speaking at a parish in your area sometime soon. And so this question from this week is from Joe. Joe C. says, Dear Miracle Hunter, what was the most incredible place you have filmed an episode of Explore? Well, Joe is referring to my television series on EWTN, my travel series that's been going on for the last few years here. On Saturdays at 5:30 p.m. Central Time is an episode about me traveling somewhere in the world to one of the most famous places of miracles. And this week we're going to be doing an episode on Warsaw. Last week was Legnica in Poland, and some other places in South America are coming up right around the corner as far as new episodes that are being featured on EWTN. It's been such a tremendous blessing to be able to go to these places and film them and bring them to you, available on ondemand.ewtn.com and, of course, broadcast on EWTN television. And so Joe's question is a very good one. What is the most incredible place you filmed at? And it would probably take me a very long time to think through all the places. I feel like we've filmed about 80 episodes so far. And I think to places like Aparecida in Brazil, the world's largest Marian shrine, or Our Lady of Las Lajas in Colombia, the site of that miraculous image, or in Mexico City, the Guadalupe image, or Rome, or anywhere in Europe. But the place that stands out the most is the most amazing place visually and experientially probably is Mount Saint Michel in France, in the northwest part of France. It's as an incredible place to be and film that island with an old monastery on top, reaching to the heavens, and then looking out over the edge into nothingness. You see just an end of the sea kind of situation, looking out into the ocean, and it's a it's an amazing place, an ancient place, you might say, and an incredible place related to some storied apparitions of Saint Michael. And so it was amazing to climb all the way to the top and to film there at Mount Saint Michel. But so many of the episodes all around the world, even going to simple places like Tixla in Mexico and witnessing a Eucharistic miracle, that's as amazing as anything. So being able to go to these places and have the incredible access, thankfully, to the rectors and the people at those shrines to open their doors and to allow us up close to these treasures of the church has been absolutely amazing. People can go to explorewiththemiraclehunter.com and watch any of the episodes. I think 40 or 50 episodes are posted on demand, but that's available also on EWTN television on Saturdays at 5:30 p.m. Central Time. So thanks, Joe, for your question. If you have a question for the Miracle Hunter, send me an email to questions@miraclehunter.com, and maybe I'll be answering your question on the air next week. Let's take a look at the 365 Days with Mary project. We do this every week where we talk about a Marian devotion as it lines up exactly to the day's date. We all know our May 13th Fatima or February 11th Lourdes or December 12th Our Lady of Guadalupe, but believe it or not, there's a different Marian title that lines up exactly to each and every day of the calendar year somewhere in the world. And so for today's date, November 8th, we've got the Virgin of the 33 in Florida, in Uruguay in 1825. And again, I was about an hour away from this place, but I was unable to check it out when I was in South America. Maybe the next time. But the story goes that around the year 1779, the image of the Assumption was placed in a chapel by Jesuits, and on April 19th, 1825, 33 Uruguayan patriots landed on the beaches of Agraciada to commence the liberation of their country. And when they reached Florida, they went to the small church and placed the future of the nation at the feet of the Virgin. On August 25th, 1975, on the 150th anniversary of its independence, the Uruguayan nation formally declared this church a historic monument. The image was crowned canonically in 1961 by a concession of John XXIII, the next year proclaiming her patroness of Uruguay, and the Solemnity of Our Lady of the 33 is celebrated on November 8th with a pilgrimage to this shrine from all parts of the nation. And that is the Virgin of the 33 from Florida in Uruguay in 1825. For more information on this fascinating devotion or any of the hundreds of other Marian devotions from around the world, you can go to 365dayswithmary.com, pick up the book, download the free app from the iOS App Store, or go to the Facebook page and join any of the 10,000 other followers who have a different title of Mary on their Facebook feed each and every day of the calendar year. Let's take a look now at the miracle of the day. Each week, we always try to find a miracle that happened on this date in Christian history in some year, and this year is 1950, where Pope Pius XII said on today's date, November 8th, that he witnessed the miracle of the sun in the Vatican Gardens. In a handwritten note later published, Pius XII recorded seeing the same solar phenomena associated with Fatima on November 8th, 1950, and he regarded it as a sign surrounding his proclamation of the Assumption. And so that is today's miracle of the day. We always try to keep you up to date on the sainthood news as well. My series, They Might Be Saints, which airs on EWTN each week, talks about those people on the path to sainthood. And I like to tell you who is coming down the path to sainthood. We've got many people. There was just a recent statement coming out of Rome on Thursday, October 24th. The Holy Father, Pope Leo XIV, received in audience His Eminence Cardinal Marcello Semeraro, the prefect for the Dicastery for the Causes of Saints. And during this audience, the Pope authorized the same dicastery to promote a decree regarding the martyrs of God, Jan Bula and Vaclav Drobla, diocesan priests killed out of hatred for the faith between 1951 and 52 in Jalava, and that was then Czechoslovakia. And so that was diocesan priests. They were aware of the dangers they faced in the dramatic context of aversion to the church. Despite the harshness of their imprisonment and the torture they suffered, they accepted their faith with unshakable faith. They accepted their fate with unshakable faith and trusting abandonment to the will of God. And that's from the Dicastery for the Causes of Saints website. They are blessed, being declared martyrs. With one miracle, they will be declared saints. And today's might be saint of the day. We always try to talk about those people whose death anniversary or feast day lines up exactly to the day's date. For today, November 8th, the memorial is for Blessed John Duns Scotus, who lived from 1266 to 1308 in Scotland. Now, he was born in 1266 at Duns in Scotland. He was the son of a wealthy farmer. He was a friar minor at Dumfries, where his uncle, Elias Duns, was superior. And he studied at Oxford and Paris, and he was ordained in 1291 at St. Andrew's Church at age 25. He lectured at Oxford and Cambridge from 1297 to 1301, when he returned to Paris to teach and complete his doctorate. John pointed out the richness of the Augustinian Franciscan tradition, appreciated the wisdom of St. Thomas Aquinas, Aristotle and Muslim philosophers, and managed to be an independent thinker himself, and his ideas led to the founding of a school of scholastic thought called Scotism. In 1303, when King Philip the Fair tried to enlist the University of Paris on his side in a dispute with Pope Boniface VIII over the taxation of church property, but John dissented and was given 3 days to leave France. He returned to Paris in 1305 and received his doctorate, and then he taught there. In 1307, he defended the Immaculate Conception of Mary that the university officially accepted his position. In drawing on this work, Pope Pius IX solemnly defined the Immaculate Conception of Mary in 1854. And the Franciscan minister general assigned John to the Franciscan school in Cologne in Germany, and he died there the next year. And he died on November 8, 1308, of natural causes in Cologne in Germany, and he was buried in a Franciscan church near the Cologne Cathedral. He was beatified in 1991 by Pope John Paul II in the confirmation of his cult, and he was canonized by Pope John Paul II on March 20, 1993. And that is, in that year, I should say, that was the beatification date, and on March 20th, 1993, by Pope John Paul II. And that is Blessed John Duns Scotus from Scotland. With one more miracle, you will be known as Saint John Duns Scotus. And for those people interested in They Might Be Saints, you can pick up my book, They Might Be Saints, which is, I think it's my best one. It's available from EWTNRC.com, the religious catalog. People can go there and buy the book about 22 Americans on the path to sainthood. Or you can check out my series, They Might Be Saints, which airs weekly on EWTN. And on Tuesday, November 11th, They Might Be Saints, Bishop Alphonse Gallegos airs. And he strolled the streets of Sacramento, saving souls by visiting families and mixing with lowriders in the Latino community. I profile the Bishop of the Barrios, Alphonse Gallegos, in this episode of They Might Be Saints. Check that one out on Tuesday, November 11th. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be talking with Dr. Mark Miravalli about the Vatican's new statement on Marian titles. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter. On EWTN, here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. On November 4th, the Vatican came out with a new document that addresses the use of various titles of the Virgin Mary, talking about appropriate and inappropriate ways, they're saying, to refer to Mary. And specifically in this document, Mater Populi Fidelis, the Mother of the Faithful People of God, the DDF is pointing to some titles in particular, I believe, Co-Redemptrix and Mediatrix. And it's saying that those are not appropriate ways to describe Mary's participation in salvation. Well, this has been somewhat of a debate over decades, perhaps, or even recent years, where these titles have been considered or been proposed to Rome for recognition in a fifth Marian dogma. But this is the statement coming out of Rome in an official document, and it was a press conference on November 4th. Well, we're very happy and grateful to be joined by Dr. Mark Miravalli, perhaps the expert here in the United States on this this title of Mary as Co-Redemptrix, Mediatrix, Fifth Marian Dogma. We're so excited and happy that he's available to talk to us today about these happenings in Rome as of November 4th. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Miravalli.
Thank you, Michael. Always a joy to be with you.
So this was big news, and I think that perhaps we even spoke about this some time ago, even that this was coming, that this was this clarification, we might call it, was coming from Rome, perhaps following some of the decisions related to Marian apparitions in recent years past, and then this 2024 document related to the new norms for judging alleged private revelation. But this was the follow-up document that was alluded to over months, and now it's here. What is the big takeaway from this that was released this week?
Well, Michael, I think there's a couple items. First of all, is while the document clearly teaches the role of Mary, her subordinate role with and under Jesus in the work of redemption, they do not like the title Co-Redemptrix. They think that it is a title that could cause confusion, possibly connote equality and such things. And so they have concluded that the title is, quote, inappropriate in number 22. Now, the challenge with that is, ironically, 41 years to the day the document was released on November 4th, on November 4th, 1984, John Paul II called Our Lady Co-Redemptrix, and he did so on six other occasions. And Pius the 11th did before him. Pius the 10th had it under his magisterium. Actually, Leo the 13th was the first pope to approve the title, along with, you know, saints like Mother Teresa, Padre Pio, Saint Jose Maria Escriva, Cardinal Newman, Saint John Newman, who actually clearly defends the title Co-Redemptrix, Sister Lucia, and many others, as well as its place in many church-approved apparitions. And so it begs the question, does that mean all those usages are inappropriate? So there's, I think, understandable confusion and questioning by probably hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Christians and Catholics throughout the world on how do those two things go together? How do you say that the title is inappropriate and yet it's been used by popes and post-conciliar popes like St. John Paul II? So I think that's the first area of confusion that comes with this. And also there's a strong conditioning of the title Mediatrix of All Graces. Now, they don't prohibit it, but they talk about its potential dangers. Again, Michael, the challenge and the confusion is coming because Our Lady's role as the Mediatrix of All Graces has been officially taught by the Papal Magisterium, starting with Pope Benedict XIV in the 18th century, up to and including Pope Leo, who used the title Mediatrix of Graces on August 15th of 2025. So it once again, if this is a title and a role that so many popes, this is in four separate papal encyclicals, and now it's being questioned as to both its doctrinal integrity and also the legitimacy of the title, you know, these are understandably causing confusion among the faithful. So those are kind of the two, I think, principal elements that come forward from this document. It is a DDF document. It's, you know, was approved in audience with the Holy Father. And at the same time, I think this is part of the overall development that happens for eventual definitions. And if I can say in this endless initial statement, this in no way prevents an eventual solemn definition of this. In fact, I think it encourages it because it's examining the doctrine behind the titles, Michael. And that's what we have to remember is the church doesn't define the titles first. It defines the doctrine, the truth that's represented with the title. So it's like Mother of God, or, you know, the title Immaculate Conception never appears in the definition of the Immaculate Conception. It's the truth that it conveys, and certainly this document does not in any way impede or prevent the ongoing prayer and petitioning for a fifth Marian dogmatic proclamation of these Marian truths.
So would we say that Pope Benedict the 16th commented on this in some way, questioning its role in Christian unity, if whether that would be preventing that in some way? Does this document sort of suggest that the reason that not to use the titles is because it's confusing, or is it saying that the theology is wrong?
That's a very good distinction, and it does not say anything about the theology. In fact, it gives a fairly competent summary of the Church's teaching on Mary's subordinate role with and under Jesus in the accomplishment of redemption. So it seems to argue in number 22, it basically says if a title has to be re-explained over and over, then it's not good for the people of God. The problem with that from a theological perspective, Michael, and again, I give respect to that which comes forward from the Dicastery, but theologically, we explain the Immaculate Conception most every day and have to re-explain it, and that Mary's Mother of God every day. Imagine how much explanation it takes to explain papal infallibility or transubstantiation. And yet, these are not titles we want to do away with. We want to explain them and continue to explain them. So from a theological perspective, I'm not sure the rationale for rejecting the co-redemptrix title really fits in with other critical titles in the church that do, in fact, require, because of their sacred deposit, ongoing explanation. And I think that's actually a positive element that helps for evangelization. That gives us an opportunity to explain these things rather than to minimize their veracity.
We're talking today with Dr. Mark Miravalli about this brand new document that came out from Rome this past week, Mater Populi Fidelis, Mother of the Faithful People of God, that looks to correct or instruct the faithful related to the titles co-redemptrix and mediatrix, referring to Mary. Now, one of the things that caught my attention in the document is, and you kind of alluded to it in some way, that in the past we've heard popes use these titles, and we've also found them in private revelation. And under the section 75, it says, should expressions or titles such as those mentioned above emerge in cases of alleged private supernatural phenomena that have already received a positive judgment from the church, one ought to bear in mind that whenever a nihil obstat is granted by the dicastery, such phenomena do not become objects of faith, which means the faithful are not obliged to give assent of faith to them. So I know of a number of cases throughout history. In Amsterdam in 1945, those apparitions to Edith Hurtman that were claimed and have since received a negative judgment from Rome, initially a positive judgment from the local bishop. In Lipa in the Philippines in 1948, also the local bishop there, Bishop Arguelles, gave a positive judgment at some point along the way, sort of a back and forth, also received a negative judgment. When this document is referring to a positive judgment from the church related to apparitions or supernatural phenomena that sort of positively talk about co-redemptrix and mediatrix, what are they talking about exactly? Which approved apparitions might we be referring to in this?
Yeah. Well, I think in principle, Michael, what they're saying is, they're fully aware that not in a few, but in most of the approved apparitions, things like Rosa Mystica, Luisa Picaretta just recently had her theology approved as being free from error for her cause, for the cause of saints, for the divine will, and San Nicholas, Our Lady is referred to as co-redemptrix, etc., that the DDF is saying, look, this is just a reality that these are present there, and we kind of have to address that. So I think the way they address it is by saying, look, if you find these titles, things like co-redemptrix, mediatrix of all graces, in private revelation, which quite frankly you do almost always, then know that they're not objects of faith. Well, that's certainly true in itself, Michael, because no apparition is an object of faith. But what I think might not be alluded to is the fact that there can be a confirmation of the authenticity and the legitimacy of titles when Jesus and Our Lady use them directly in church-approved messages. Now, as we know, with the 2024 norms, the bishop is no longer capable of making a declaration of supernatural character. Nonetheless, when the DDF has approved some of the recent approvals that they've done, they've pointed out things like co-redemptrix and mediatrix of all graces, and given it, you know, slightly an interpretation, let's say, that's different than, for example, John Paul II's treatment of these same truths. John Paul used co-redemptrix 7 times. He calls Mary mediatrix of all graces 8 times. So I think it's the DDF's effort to kind of take care of the category of private revelation. But in fact, the reality is that private revelation almost always makes reference to Our Lady as co-redemptrix or mediatrix of all graces. And I would see that theologically as a sign of their authenticity and their legitimacy.
So I suppose going forward, perhaps they're going to pay special attention to their approvals, giving Nihil Obstat for this title if it's present. But in this document, they're saying that if these things are found in past approvals, we're supposed to ignore that. No, ignore it at that point. I can't read.
Well, I would use diplomatic Vatican language, Michael, and I think it would be what they say in. It precisely is they're not objects of faith because they're private revelation. But we know that. I mean, that's a basic principle that we're never obliged to accept a private revelation. I think it is a sidestepping, let us say, the reality that Jesus and Mary don't use false titles. And I would dare say we could even say they don't use inappropriate titles. So I think it's a bit of a catch-all paragraph says what we know. They're not objects of faith, but it may not fully appreciate the fact that they seem to support the legitimacy of these titles, which, you know, popes and saints and mystics have been using. I mean, when you talk about things like Anne Catherine Emmerich or Mary of Agreda or, the Co-Redemptrix Mediatrix is all over the place with these traditional, as well as Bridget of Sweden and Catherine of Siena. So, I mean, that's just a fact of history that these are titles throughout the mystical tradition of the Church, Co-Redemptrix and Mediatrix of All Graces.
We're talking today with Dr. Mark Miravalli about the brand new document coming out of Rome, Mater Populi Fidelis, the Mother of the People of God, that the DDF has just released related to specifically titles of Mary, specifically Co-Redemptrix, Mediatrix. And they have mentioned a few titles in there that that are approved or acceptable titles of Mary. What was the motivation for outlining or delineating some of the titles of Mary that are approved when we've known they're approved the whole time?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think perhaps it was to show that it's not solely a negatively focused document. But I would agree with you, calling Mary Mother of Grace is certainly not a controversial title. Although, once again, the document does specify that, in its words, that if you consider Mary to be a universal dispenser of graces, that, that should not be an accurate portrayal anymore. Again, I think that raises the issue, and this is part of the potential synodal dialogue that we can have with the DDF on this question, but that's exactly what it meant when Pope Leo the 13th talked about it in his encyclicals and the various popes. I mean, four different encyclicals, 10 papal teachings say that Mary mediates the graces, that she actually is a secondary universal cause of the distribution of graces. So, it always is going to cause some difficulty when a doctoral commission says something that appears to be rather contrary to magisterial teachings. So, hopefully there can be greater clarification and harmony between the papal magisterium and documents that come out of the DDF that are supposed to, help us more deeply and appropriately understand what the papal magisterium teaches on Our Lady.
And as we wrap up the interview today, of course, this has been a controversial topic, and this will continue to be, I suppose. What is the appropriate stance of docility or acceptance of the Church's teaching for those Christians out there? Even the document, it says, quote, there are some Marian reflection groups, publications, new devotions, requests for Marian dogmas that do not share the characteristics as popular devotion, the same characteristics as popular devotion. What is the appropriate response for those people who, for this might be a difficult document coming from the Vatican?
Yeah, I think, Michael, we have to realize that defining dogmas is a process. So with the Immaculate Conception, it was really seven centuries of controversy. I hope and pray it's not seven centuries for the definition of Our Lady's role as our spiritual mother, inclusive of her unique role in the redemption with and under Jesus and her role in the mediation of graces. Now, people could certainly not, if there was a desire to not use the title co-redemptrix, especially if it's been now designated as inappropriate. The words like, you know, the role of Mary in redemption articulates exactly the same thing. And that's precisely, Michael, why this doesn't impede the ongoing movement, which is already 100 years old, for an eventual solemn definition of our spiritual mother, of Our Lady's spiritual motherhood, based on her unique cooperation in redemption and mediation. I mean, that's ultimately, Michael, why dogmas happen. It's not the exclusive reason, but oftentimes they happen to give definitive clarification on a doctrine that has some controversy. Well, I think this very much fits the bill right now. I think the confusion over this, the kind of the historic kind of change where, you know, now a title previously used positively and by popes is now seen as inappropriate. Well, this becomes a good opportunity to further examine, articulate, define eventually this truth. So I would encourage people, do not get discouraged. Continue to pray. Of course, you can always pray and petition the Holy Father for development of doctrine. This is Canon 212, number two, that the faithful are obliged to bring to the attention of the faithful, the attention of the authorities of the church, the pastors of the church, things that they believe are important for the good of the church. And there's at least 8 million people and 700 bishops who believe that defining Mary, her spiritual motherhood, is really for the good of the church, that it will release historic graces. And so, of course, people can continue to pray and petition the Holy Father for this, because ultimately it comes to the heart of Pope Leo. I think he has a very Marian heart, and I think it merits our prayers and continued efforts, and not to get discouraged, to continue on as part of the process, which I believe will eventually clearly lead to, ultimately, a solemn definition of Our Lady's relationship with humanity.
Well, we're so grateful to you, Dr. Mark Miravalli, for joining us today to talk about this brand new document coming out of Rome, Mother of the People, Faithful People of God. Thank you so much, Dr. Miravalli, for joining us on today's program.
My pleasure, Michael. God bless you.
God bless. That was Dr. Mark Miravalli. Check him out at motherofallpeoples.com. Fascinating conversation about this brand new title, brand new document related to the titles of Mary. And that's all the time we have for today's show. If you missed any of this episode or want to catch up on past episodes, you can go to ewtn.com/radio, check out the audio archives, or download the free EWTN app. I'd like to thank our guest today, Dr. Mark Miravalli, talking to us about the new Vatican Statement on Marian Titles, and also Terry Haggerty, the Executive Director of the Trinity Heights Queen of Peace Shrine. And that's the subject of the new Hidden Gems episode airing on November 10th at 4:30 p.m. Central Time. And check out my series, Explore with the Miracle Hunter, coming up on November 15th at 5:30 p.m. Central Time, a brand new episode on Warsaw, Explore Warsaw. So in 1920, Polish forces won a surprising victory against the Soviets to halt communist advance. And I investigate the divine intervention that may have turned the tide. And that's Saturday, November 15th at 5:30 p.m. Central Time, Explore with the Miracle Hunter, Warsaw. And I'd like to thank you for joining me today on Miracle Hunter, where from claims of healings and visions to the world's most inexplicable events, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt. Talk to you next week.